Understand me if I say that I'd like you to give that bracelet back to me. I understand you, but I will not give it back. Lillian let a moment pass, as if to let them both acknowledge the meaning of their silence. For once she held Dagny's glance without smiling. What do you expect me to think, Miss Taggart? Anything you wish. What is your motive? You knew my motive when you gave me the bracelet. Lillian glanced at Reardon. His face was expressionless. She saw no reaction, no hint of intention to help her or stop her, nothing but an attentiveness that made her feel as if she were standing in a spotlight. Her smile came back as a protective shield, an amused, patronizing smile intended to convert the subject into a drawing-room issue again. I'm sure, Miss Taggart, that you realize how enormously improper this is. No. But surely you know that you are taking a dangerous and ugly risk. No. You do not take into consideration the possibility of being misunderstood. No. Lillian shook her head in smiling reproach. Miss Taggart. Don't you think that this is a case where one cannot afford to indulge in abstract theory, but must consider practical reality? Dagny would not smile. I have never understood what is meant by a statement of that kind. I mean that your attitude may be highly idealistic, as I am sure it is, but unfortunately most people do not share your lofty frame of mind and will misinterpret your action in the one manner which would be most abhorrent to you. Then the responsibility and the risk will be theirs, not mine. I admire your... No, I must not say innocence. But shall I say... purity. You have never thought of it, I'm sure, but life is not as straight and logical as a railroad track. It is regrettable, but possible, that your high intentions may lead people to suspect things which I'm sure you know to be of a sordid and scandalous nature. Dagny was looking straight at her. I don't. But you cannot ignore that possibility. I do. Dagny turned to go. Oh, but should you wish to evade a discussion if you have nothing to hide? Dagny stopped. And if your brilliant and reckless courage permits you to gamble with your reputation, should you ignore the danger to Mr. Reardon? Dagny asked slowly, What is the danger to Mr. Reardon? I'm sure you understand me. I don't. Oh, but surely it isn't necessary to be more explicit. It is, if you wish to continue this discussion. Lillian's eyes went to Reardon's face, searching for some sign to help her decide whether to continue or to stop. He would not help her. Miss Taggart, she said, I am not your equal in philosophical altitude. I am only an average wife. Please give me that bracelet, if you do not wish me to think what I might think and what you wouldn't want me to name. Mrs. Reardon, is this the manner and place in which you choose to suggest that I am sleeping with your husband? Certainly not. The cry was immediate. It had a sound of panic and the quality of an automatic reflex, like the jerk of withdrawal of a pickpocket's hand caught in action. She added, with an angry, nervous chuckle, in a tone of sarcasm and sincerity that confessed a reluctant admission of her actual opinion, That would be the possibility farthest from my mind. Then you will please apologize to Miss Taggart, said Reardon. Dagny caught her breath, cutting off all but the faint echo of a gasp. They both whirled to him. Lillian saw nothing in his face. Dagny saw torture. It isn't necessary, Hank, she said. It is. For me, he answered coldly, not looking at her. He was looking at Lillian in the manner of a command that could not be disobeyed. Lillian studied his face with mild astonishment, but without anxiety or anger, like a person confronted by a puzzle of no significance. "But of course," she said complacently, her voice smooth and confident again. "Please accept my apology, Miss Taggart, if I gave you the impression that I suspected the existence of a relationship which I would consider improbable for you and, from my knowledge of his inclinations, impossible for my husband." She turned and walked away indifferently, leaving them together, as if in deliberate proof of her words. Dagny stood still, her eyes closed. She was thinking of the night when Lillian had given her the bracelet. He had taken his wife's side then. He had taken hers now. Of the three of them, she was the only one who understood fully what this meant. "Whatever is the worst you may wish to say to me, you will be right." She heard him and opened her eyes. He was looking at her coldly, his face harsh, allowing no sign of pain or apology to suggest a hope of forgiveness. "Dearest, don't torture yourself like that," she said. "I knew that you're married. I've never tried to evade that knowledge. I'm not hurt by it tonight." Her first word was the most violent of the several blows he felt. She had never used that word before. She had never let him hear that particular tone of tenderness. She had never spoken of his marriage in the privacy of their meetings, yet she spoke of it here with effortless simplicity. She saw the anger in his face, the rebellion against pity, the look of saying to her contemptuously that he had betrayed no torture and needed no help, then the look of the realization that she knew his face as thoroughly as he knew hers. He closed his eyes, he inclined his head a little, and he said very quietly, "Thank you." She smiled and turned away from him. James Taggart held an empty champagne glass in his hand and noticed the haste with which Balf Eubank waved at a passing waiter, as if the waiter were guilty of an unpardonable lapse. Then Eubank completed his sentence. "But you, Mr. Taggart, would know that a man who lives on a higher plane cannot be understood or appreciated. It's a hopeless struggle, trying to obtain support for literature from a world ruled by businessmen. They are nothing but stuffy, middle-class vulgarians, or else predatory savages like Reardon." "Jim," said Bertram Scudder, slapping his shoulder, "the best compliment I can pay you is that you're not a real businessman." "You're a man of culture, Jim," said Dr. Pritchett. "You're not an ex-ore digger like Reardon. I don't have to explain to you the crucial need of Washington assistance to higher education." "You really liked my last novel, Mr. Taggart?" Balf Eubank kept asking. "You really liked it?" Orrin Boyle glanced at the group on his way across the room, but did not stop. The glance was sufficient to give him an estimate of the nature of the group's concerns. Fair enough, he thought. One's got to trade something. He knew, but did not care to name, just what was being traded. "We are at the dawn of a new age," said James Taggart from above the rim of his champagne glass. "We are breaking up the vicious tyranny of economic power. We will set men free of the rule of the dollar. We will release our spiritual aims from dependence on the owners of material means. We will liberate our culture from the stranglehold of the profit chasers. We will build a society dedicated to higher ideals, and we will replace the aristocracy of money by the aristocracy of pull," said a voice beyond the group. They whirled around. The man who stood facing them was Francisco D'Anconia. His face looked tanned by a summer sun, and his eyes were the exact color of the sky on the kind of day when he had acquired his tan. His smile suggested a summer morning. The way he wore his formal clothes made the rest of the crowd look as if they were masquerading in borrowed costumes. "What's the matter?" he asked in the midst of their silence. "Did I say something that somebody here didn't know?" "How did you get here?" was the first thing James Taggart found himself able to utter. "By plane to Newark. by taxi from there, then by elevator from my suite 53 floors above you. I didn't mean... That is, what I meant was... Don't look so startled, James. If I land in New York and hear that there's a party going on, I wouldn't miss it, would I? You've always said that I'm just a party hound. The group was watching them. I'm delighted to see you, of course, Taggart said cautiously, then added belligerently to balance it. But if you think you're going to... Francisco would not pick up the threat. He let Taggart's sentence slide into midair and stop, then asked politely, If I think what? You understand me very well. Yes, I do. Shall I tell you what I think? This is hardly the moment for any... I think you should present me to your bride, James. Your manners have never been glued to you too solidly. You always lose them in an emergency, and that's the time when one needs them most. Turning to escort him towards Cheryl, Taggart caught the faint sound that came from Bertram Scudder. It was an unborn chuckle. Taggart knew that the men who had crawled at his feet a moment ago, whose hatred for Francisco D'Anconia was perhaps greater than his own, were enjoying the spectacle nonetheless. The implications of this knowledge were among the things he did not care to name. Francisco bowed to Cheryl and offered his best wishes, as if she were the bride of a royal heir. Watching nervously, Taggart felt relief, and a touch of nameless resentment, which, if named, would have told him he wished the occasion deserved the grandeur that Francisco's manner gave it for a moment. He was afraid to remain by Francisco's side, and afraid to let him loose among the guests. He backed a few tentative steps away, but Francisco followed him, smiling. "You didn't think I'd want to miss your wedding, James, when you're my childhood friend and best stockholder." "What?" gasped Taggart, and regretted it. The sound was a confession of panic. Francisco did not seem to take note of it. He said, his voice gaily innocent, "Oh, but of course I know it. I know the stooge behind every name on the list of the stockholders of D'Anconia Copper. It's surprising how many men by the name of Smith and Gomez are rich enough to own big chunks of the richest corporation in the world. So you can't blame me if I was curious to learn what distinguished persons I actually have among my minority stockholders. I seem to be popular with an astonishing collection of public figures from all over the world, from people's states where you wouldn't think there's any money left at all." Taggart said dryly, frowning, "There are many reasons, business reasons, why it is sometimes advisable not to make one's investments directly. One reason is that a man doesn't want people to know he's rich. Another is that he doesn't want them to learn how he got that way." "I don't know what you mean, or why you should object."
"Oh, I don't object at all. I appreciate it. A great many investors, the old-fashioned sort, dropped me after the San Sebastian mines. It scared them away. But the modern ones had more faith in me and acted as they always do, on faith. I can't tell you how thoroughly I appreciate it."
Taggart wished Francisco would not talk so loudly. He wished people would not gather around them. "You have been doing extremely well," he said, in the safe tone of a business compliment. "Yes, haven't I? It's wonderful how the stock of D'Anconia Copper has risen within the last year. But I don't think I should be too conceited about it. There's not much competition left in the world. There's no place to invest one's money if one happens to get rich quickly. And here's D'Anconia Copper, the oldest company on Earth, the one that's been the safest bet for centuries. Just think of what it managed to survive through the ages. So if you people have decided that it's the best place for your hidden money, that it can't be beaten, that it would take a most unusual kind of man to destroy D'Anconia Copper, you were right. Well,
I hear it said that you've begun to take your responsibility seriously, and that you've settled down to business at last. They say you've been working very hard. Oh, has anybody noticed that? It was the old-fashioned investors who made it a point to watch what the president of a company was doing. The modern investors don't find knowledge necessary. I don't think they ever look into my activities.
Taggart smiled. They look at the ticker tape of the stock exchange. That tells the whole story, doesn't it?
Yes.
Yes, it does. In the long run. I must say I'm glad that you haven't been much of a party hound this past year. The results show in your work.
Do they?
Well, no, not quite yet.
I suppose, said Taggart, in the cautious tone of an indirect question, that I should feel flattered you chose to come to this party.
Oh, but I had to come. I thought you were expecting me.
Why, no, I wasn't. That is, I mean, you should have expected me, James. This is the great, formal, nose-counting event, where the victims come in order to show how safe it is to destroy them, and the destroyers form pacts of eternal friendship, which lasts for 3 months. I don't know exactly which group I belong to, but I had to come and be counted, didn't I?
What in hell do you think you're saying? Taggart cried furiously, seeing the tension on the faces around them.
Be careful, James. If you try to pretend that you don't understand me, I'm going to make it much clearer.
If you think it's proper to utter such...
I think it's funny. There was a time when men were afraid that somebody would reveal some secret of theirs that was unknown to their fellows. Nowadays they're afraid that somebody will name what everybody knows. Have you practical people ever thought that that's all it would take to blast your whole big, complex structure with all your laws and guns? Just somebody naming the exact nature of what you're doing?
If you think it's proper to come to a celebration such as a wedding in order to insult the host,
why, James, I came here to thank you.
To thank me?
Of course. You've done me a great favor. You and your boys in Washington and the boys in Santiago. Only I wonder why none of you took the trouble to inform me about it. Those directives that somebody issued here a few months ago are choking off the entire copper industry of this country. And the result is that this country suddenly has to import much larger amounts of copper. And where in the world is there any copper left? Unless it's Danconia copper. So you see that I have good reason to be grateful.
I assure you I had nothing to do with it, Taggart said hastily. And besides, the vital economic policies of this country are not determined by any considerations such as your intimating or...
I know how they're determined, James. I know that the deal started with the boys in Santiago, because they've been on the Danconia payroll for centuries.
Well, no, payroll is an honorable word. It would be more exact to say that Danconia copper has been paying them protection money for centuries. Isn't that what your gangsters call it? Our boys in Santiago call it taxes. They've been getting their cut on every ton of Danconia copper sold. So they have a vested interest to see me sell as many tons as possible. But with the world turning into people's states, this is the only country left where men are not yet reduced to digging for roots in forests for their sustenance. So this is the only market left on earth. The boys in Santiago wanted to corner this market. I don't know what they offered to the boys in Washington, or who traded what and to whom, but I know that you came in on it somewhere, because you do hold a sizable chunk of Danconia copper stock. And it surely didn't displease you. That morning, 4 months ago, the day after the directives were issued, to see the kind of soaring leap that Danconia copper performed on the stock exchange.
Why, it practically leaped off the ticker tape and into your face.
Who gave you any grounds to invent an outrageous story of this kind?
Nobody. I knew nothing about it. I just saw the leap on the ticker tape that morning. That told the whole story, didn't it? Besides, the boys in Santiago slapped a new tax on copper the following week, and they told me that I shouldn't mind it, not with that sudden rise of my stock. They were working for my best interests, they said. They said, why should I care? Taking the two events together, I was richer than I had been before. True enough, I was.
Why do you wish to tell me this?
Why don't you wish to take any credit for it, James? That's out of character and out of policy at which you're such an expert. In an age when men exist not by right but by favor, one does not reject a grateful person. One tries to trap into gratitude as many people as possible. Don't you want to have me as one of your men under obligation?
I don't know what you're talking about.
Think what a favor I received without any effort on my part. I wasn't consulted. I wasn't informed. I wasn't thought about. Everything was arranged without me. And all I have to do now is produce the copper. That was a great favor, James, and you may be sure that I will repay it.
Francisco turned abruptly, not waiting for an answer, and started away. Taggart did not follow. He stood, feeling that anything was preferable to one more minute of their conversation. Francisco stopped when he came to Dagny. He looked at her for a silent instant, without greeting, his smile acknowledging that she had been the first person he saw and the first one to see him at his entrance into the ballroom. Against every doubt and warning in her mind, she felt nothing but a joyous confidence. Inexplicably, she felt as if his figure in that crowd was a point of indestructible security. But in the moment when the beginning of a smile told him how glad she was to see him, he asked, "Don't you want to tell me what a brilliant achievement the John Galt line turned out to be?" She felt her lips trembling and tightening at once as she answered, "I'm sorry if I show that I'm still open to be hurt. It shouldn't shock me that you've come to the stage where you despise achievement."
"Yes, don't I? I despised that line so much that I didn't want to see it reach the kind of end it has reached."
He saw her look of sudden attentiveness, the look of thought rushing into a breach torn open upon a new direction. He watched her for a moment, as if he knew every step she would find along that road, then chuckled and said, "Don't you want to ask me now, who is John Galt?"
"Why should I want to? And why now?"
"Don't you remember that you dared him to come and claim your line?"
"He has."
He walked on, not waiting to see the look in her eyes, a look that held anger, bewilderment, and the first faint gleam of a question mark. It was the muscles of his own face that made Reardon realize the nature of his reaction to Francisco's arrival. He noticed suddenly that he was smiling, and that his face had been relaxed into the dim well-being of a smile for some minutes past, as he watched Francisco D'Anconia in the crowd. He acknowledged to himself for the first time all the half-grasped, half-rejected moments when he had thought of Francisco D'Anconia and thrust the thought aside before it became the knowledge of how much he wanted to see him again. In moments of sudden exhaustion, at his desk, with the fires of the furnaces going down in the twilight, in the darkness of the lonely walk through the empty countryside to his house, in the silence of sleepless nights, he had found himself thinking of the only man who had once seemed to be his spokesman. He had pushed the memory aside, telling himself, "But that one is worse than all the others," while feeling certain that this was not true, yet being unable to name the reason of his certainty. He had caught himself glancing through the newspapers to see whether Francisco D'Anconia had returned to New York, and he had thrown the newspapers aside, asking himself angrily, what if he did return? Would you go chasing him through nightclubs and cocktail parties? What is it that you want from him? This was what he had wanted, he thought, when he caught himself smiling at the sight of Francisco in the crowd. This strange feeling of expectation that held curiosity, amusement, and hope. Francisco did not seem to have noticed him. Reardon waited, fighting a desire to approach. Not after the kind of conversation we had, he thought. What for? What would I say to him? And then, with the same smiling, light-hearted feeling, the feeling of being certain that it was right, he found himself walking across the ballroom toward the group that surrounded Francisco D'Anconia. He wondered, looking at them, why these people were drawn to Francisco, why they chose to hold him imprisoned in a clinging circle when their resentment of him was obvious under their smiles. Their faces had the hint of a look peculiar, not to fear, but to cowardice, a look of guilty anger. Francisco stood cornered against the side edge of a marble stairway, half leaning, half sitting on the steps. The informality of his posture, combined with the strict formality of his clothes, gave him an air of superlative elegance. His was the only face that had the carefree look and the brilliant smile proper to the enjoyment of a party. But his eyes seemed intentionally expressionless, holding no trace of gaiety, showing, like a warning signal, nothing but the activity of a heightened perceptiveness. Standing unnoticed on the edge of the group, Reardon heard a woman, who had large diamond earrings and a flabby, nervous face, ask tensely,
"Señor D'Anconia, what do you think is going to happen to the world?"
"Just exactly what it deserves."
"Oh, how cruel!"
"Don't you believe in the operation of the moral law, madam?" Francisco asked gravely. "I do." Reardon heard Bertram Scudder, outside the group, say to a girl who made some sound of indignation, "Don't let him disturb you. You know, money is the root of all evil, and he is the typical product of money." Reardon did not think that Francisco could have heard it, but he saw Francisco turning to them with a gravely courteous smile. "So you think that money is the root of all evil?" said Francisco D'Anconia. "Have you ever asked what is the root of money?" "Money is a tool of exchange, which can't exist unless there are goods produced and men able to produce them. Money is the material shape of the principle that men who wish to deal with one another must deal by trade and give value for value. Money is not the tool of the moochers, who claim your product by tears, or of the looters, who take it from you by force. Money is made possible only by the men who produce. Is this what you consider evil? When you accept money in payment for your effort, you do so only on the conviction that you will exchange it for the product of the effort of others. It is not the moochers or the looters who give value to money. Not an ocean of tears nor all the guns in the world can transform those pieces of paper in your wallet into the bread you will need to survive tomorrow. Those pieces of paper, which should have been gold, are a token of honor. Your claim upon the energy of the men who produce. Your wallet is your statement of hope that somewhere in the world around you there are men who will not default on that moral principle which is the root of money. Is this what you consider evil? Have you ever looked for the root of production? Take a look at an electric generator and dare tell yourself that it was created by the muscular effort of unthinking brutes. Try to grow a seed of wheat without the knowledge left to you by men who had to discover it for the first time. Try to obtain your food by means of nothing but physical motions, and you'll learn that man's mind is the root of all the goods produced and of all the wealth that has ever existed on earth. But you say that money is made by the strong at the expense of the weak? What strength do you mean? It is not the strength of guns or muscles.
Wealth is the product of man's capacity to think. Then is money made by the man who invents a motor at the expense of those who did not invent it? Is money made by the intelligent at the expense of the fools? By the able at the expense of the incompetent? By the ambitious at the expense of the lazy? Money is made before it can be looted or mooched, made by the effort of every honest man, each to the extent of his ability. An honest man is one who knows that he can't consume more than he has produced. To trade by means of money is the code of the men of goodwill. Money rests on the axiom that every man is the owner of his mind and his effort. Money allows no power to prescribe the value of your effort except the voluntary choice of the man who is willing to trade you his effort in return. Money permits you to obtain for your goods and your labor that which they are worth to the men who buy them, but no more. Money permits no deals except those to mutual benefit by the unforced judgment of the traders. Money demands of you the recognition that men must work for their own benefit, not for their own injury, for their gain, not their loss. The recognition that they are not beasts of burden, born to carry the weight of your misery, that you must offer them values, not wounds, that the common bond among men is not the exchange of suffering, but the exchange of goods. Money demands that you sell not your weakness to men's stupidity, but your talent to their reason. It demands that you buy not the shoddiest they offer, but the best that your money can find. And when men live by trade, with reason, not force, as their final arbiter, it is the best product that wins, the best performance, the man of best judgment and highest ability. And the degree of a man's productiveness is the degree of his reward. This is the code of existence whose tool and symbol is money. Is this what you consider evil? But money is only a tool. It will take you wherever you wish, but it will not replace you as the driver. It will give you the means for the satisfaction of your desires, but it will not provide you with desires. Money is the scourge of the men who attempt to reverse the law of causality, the men who seek to replace the mind by seizing the products of the mind. Money will not purchase happiness for the man who has no concept of what he wants. Money will not give him a code of values if he's evaded the knowledge of what to value, and it will not provide him with a purpose if he's evaded the choice of what to seek. Money will not buy intelligence for the fool, or admiration for the coward, or respect for the incompetent. The man who attempts to purchase the brains of his superiors to serve him, with his money replacing his judgment, ends up by becoming the victim of his inferiors. The men of intelligence desert him, but the cheats and the frauds come flocking to him, drawn by a law which he has not discovered, that no man may be smaller than his money. Is this the reason why you call it evil? Only the man who does not need it is fit to inherit wealth. The man who would make his own fortune no matter where he started. If an heir is equal to his money, it serves him. If not, it destroys him. But you look on and you cry that money corrupted him. Did it? Or did he corrupt his money? Do not envy a worthless heir. His wealth is not yours, and you would have done no better with it. Do not think that it should have been distributed among you. Loading the world with 50 parasites instead of one would not bring back the dead virtue which was the fortune. Money is a living power that dies without its root. Money will not serve the mind that cannot match it. Is this the reason why you call it evil? Money is your means of survival. The verdict you pronounce upon the source of your livelihood is the verdict you pronounce upon your life. If the source is corrupt, You have damned your own existence. Did you get your money by fraud? By pandering to men's vices or men's stupidity? By catering to fools in the hope of getting more than your ability deserves? By lowering your standards? By doing work you despise for purchasers you scorn? If so, then your money will not give you a moment's or a penny's worth of joy. Then all the things you buy will become not a tribute to you, but a reproach, not an achievement, but a reminder of shame. Then you'll scream that money is evil. Evil because it would not pinch hit for your self-respect. Evil because it would not let you enjoy your depravity. Is this the root of your hatred of money? Money will always remain an effect and refuse to replace you as the cause. Money is the product of virtue, but it will not give you virtue, and it will not redeem your vices. Money will not give you the unearned, neither in matter nor in spirit. Is this the root of your hatred of money? Or did you say it's the love of money that's the root of all evil? To love a thing is to know and love its nature. To love money is to know and love the fact that money is the creation of the best power within you, and your passkey to trade your effort for the effort of the best among men. It's the person who would sell his soul for a nickel who is loudest in proclaiming his hatred of money, and he has good reason to hate it. The lovers of money are willing to work for it. They know they are able to deserve it. Let me give you a tip on a clue to men's characters. The man who damns money has obtained it dishonorably. The man who respects it has earned it. Run for your life from any man who tells you that money is evil. That sentence is the leper's bell of an approaching looter. So long as men live together on earth and need means to deal with one another, their only substitute, if they abandon money, is the muzzle of a gun. But money demands of you the highest virtues, if you wish to make it or to keep it. Men who have no courage, pride, or self-esteem, men who have no moral sense of their right to the money and are not willing to defend it as they defend their life, men who apologize for being rich will not remain rich for long. They are the natural bait for the swarms of looters that stay under rocks for centuries, but come crawling out at the first smell of a man who begs to be forgiven for the guilt of owning wealth. They will hasten to relieve him of the guilt and of his life, as he deserves. Then you will see the rise of the men of the double standard. The men who live by force, yet count on those who live by trade to create the value of their looted money. The men who are the hitchhikers of virtue. In a moral society, these are the criminals, and the statutes are written to protect you against them. But when a society establishes criminals by right and looters by law, men who use force to seize the wealth of disarmed victims, then money becomes its creator's avenger. Such looters believe it safe to rob defenseless men once they've passed a law to disarm them. But their loot becomes the magnet for other looters who get it from them as they got it. Then the race goes not to the ablest at production, but to those most ruthless at brutality. When force is the standard, the murderer wins over the pickpocket. And then that society vanishes in a spread of ruins and slaughter. Do you wish to know whether that day is coming? Watch money. Money is the barometer of a society's virtue. When you see that trading is done not by consent but by compulsion, when you see that in order to produce you need to obtain permission from men who produce nothing, when you see that money is flowing to those who deal not in goods but in favors, When you see that men get richer by graft and by pull than by work, and your laws don't protect you against them, but protect them against you. When you see corruption being rewarded and honesty becoming a self-sacrifice, you may know that your society is doomed. Money is so noble a medium that it does not compete with guns, and it does not make terms with brutality. It will not permit a country to survive as half property, half loot. Whenever destroyers appear among men, they start by destroying money, for money is men's protection and the base of a moral existence. Destroyers seize gold and leave to its owners a counterfeit pile of paper. This kills all objective standards and delivers men into the arbitrary power of an arbitrary setter of values. Gold was an objective value, an equivalent of wealth produced. Paper is a mortgage on wealth that does not exist, backed by a gun aimed at those who are expected to produce it. Paper is a check drawn by legal looters upon an account which is not theirs, upon the virtue of the victims. Watch for the day when it bounces, marked account overdrawn. When you have made evil the means of survival, do not expect men to remain good. Do not expect them to stay moral and lose their lives for the purpose of becoming the fodder of the immoral. Do not expect them to produce when production is punished and looting rewarded. Do not ask who is destroying the world. You are. You stand in the midst of the greatest achievements of the greatest productive civilization, and you wonder why it's crumbling around you, while you're damming its lifeblood. Money. You look upon money as the savages did before you, and you wonder why the jungle is creeping back to the edge of your cities. Throughout men's history, money was always seized by looters of one brand or another, whose names changed, but whose method remained the same. To seize wealth by force, and to keep the producers bound, demeaned, defamed, deprived of honor. That phrase about the evil of money, which you mouth with such righteous recklessness, comes from a time when wealth was produced by the labor of slaves. Slaves who repeated the motions once discovered by somebody's mind and left unimproved for centuries. So long as production was ruled by force and wealth was obtained by conquest, there was little to conquer. Yet through all the centuries of stagnation and starvation, men exalted the looters as aristocrats of the sword, as aristocrats of birth, as aristocrats of the bureau, and despised the producers as slaves, as traders, as shopkeepers, as industrialists. To the glory of mankind there was, for the first and only time in history, a country of money. And I have no higher, more reverent tribute to pay to America, for this means a country of reason, justice, freedom, production, achievement. For the first time, man's mind and money were set free, and there were no fortunes by conquest, but only fortunes by work. And instead of swordsmen and slaves, there appeared the real maker of wealth, the greatest worker, the highest type of human being, the self-made man, the American industrialist. If you ask me to name the proudest distinction of Americans, I would choose, because it contains all the others, the fact that they were the people who created the phrase to make money. No other language or nation had ever used these words before. Men had always thought of wealth as a static quantity, to be seized, begged, inherited, shared, looted, or obtained as a favor. Americans were the first to understand that wealth has to be created. The words, to make money, hold the essence of human morality. Yet these were the words for which Americans were denounced by the rotted cultures of the looters' continents. Now the looters' credo has brought you to regard your proudest achievements as a hallmark of shame, your prosperity as guilt, your greatest men, the industrialists, as blackguards, and your magnificent factories as the product and property of muscular labor, the labor of whip-driven slaves, like the pyramids of Egypt. The rotter who simpers that he sees no difference between the power of the dollar and the power of the whip ought to learn the difference on his own hide, as I think he will. Until and unless you discover that money is the root of all good, you ask for your own destruction. When money ceases to be the tool by which men deal with one another, then men become the tools of men. Blood, whips, and guns, or dollars. Take your choice. There is no other. And your time is running out. Francisco had not glanced at Reardon once while speaking, but the moment he finished, his eyes went straight to Reardon's face. Reardon stood motionless, seeing nothing but Francisco D'Anconia across the moving figures and angry voices between them. There were people who had listened but now hurried away, and people who said, "It's horrible. It's not true. How vicious and selfish," saying it loudly and guardedly at once, as if wishing that their neighbors would hear them, but hoping that Francisco would not. "Señor D'Anconia," declared the woman with the earrings, "I don't agree with you." "If you can refute a single sentence I uttered, madam, I shall hear it gratefully." "Oh, I can't answer you. I don't have any answers. My mind doesn't work that way. But I don't feel that you're right. So I know that you're wrong." "How do you know it?"
"I feel it. I don't go by my head, but by my heart. You might be good at logic, but you're heartless."
"Madam, when you'll see men dying of starvation around us, your heart won't be of any earthly use to save them. And I'm heartless enough to say that when you'll scream, 'But I didn't know it,' you will not be forgiven." The woman turned away, a shudder running through the flesh of her cheeks and through the angry tremor of her voice. "Well, it's certainly a funny way to talk at a party." A portly man with evasive eyes said loudly, his tone of forced cheerfulness suggesting that his sole concern in any issue was not to let it become unpleasant, "If this is the way you feel about money, senor, I think I'm darn glad that I've got a goodly piece of D'Anconia copper stock." Francisco said gravely, "I suggest that you think twice, sir." Reardon started toward him, and Francisco, who had not seemed to look in his direction, moved to meet him at once, as if the others had never existed. "Hello," said Reardon simply, easily, as to a childhood friend. He was smiling. He saw his own smile reflected in Francisco's face.
"Hello.
I want to speak to you."
"To whom do you think I've been speaking for the last quarter of an hour?"
Reardon chuckled, in the manner of acknowledging an opponent's round. "I didn't think you had noticed me."
"I noticed, when I came in, that you were one of the only two persons in this room who were glad to see me."
"Aren't you being presumptuous?"
"No. Grateful."
"Who was the other person glad to see you?"
Francisco shrugged and said lightly, "A woman."
Reardon noticed that Francisco had led him aside, away from the group, in so skillfully natural a manner that neither he nor the others had known it was being done intentionally.
"I didn't expect to find you here," said Francisco. "You shouldn't have come to this party."
"Why not?"
"May I ask what made you come?"
"My wife was anxious to accept the invitation."
"Forgive me if I put it in such form, but it would have been more proper and less dangerous if she had asked you to take her on a tour of whorehouses."
"What danger are you talking about?"
"Mr. Reardon, you do not know these people's way of doing business, or how they interpret your presence here. In your code, but not in theirs, accepting a man's hospitality is a token of goodwill, a declaration that you and your host stand on terms of a civilized relationship.
Don't give them that kind of sanction.
Then why did you come here? Francisco shrugged gaily.
It doesn't matter what I do. I'm only a party hound.
What are you doing at this party?
Just looking for conquests.
Found any? His face suddenly earnest, Francisco answered gravely, almost solemnly,
Yes. What I think is going to be my best and greatest.
Reardon's anger was involuntary. The cry, not of reproach, but of despair. How can you waste yourself that way? The faint suggestion of a smile, like the rise of a distant light, came into Francisco's eyes as he asked,
Do you care to admit that you care about it?
You're going to hear a few more admissions, if that's what you're after. Before I met you, I used to wonder how you could waste a fortune such as yours. Now it's worse, because I can't despise you as I did, as I'd like to. Yet the question is much more terrible. How can you waste a mind such as yours?
I don't think I'm wasting it right now.
I don't know whether there's ever been anything that meant a damn to you, but I'm going to tell you what I've never said to anyone before. When I met you, do you remember that you said you wanted to offer me your gratitude? There was no trace of amusement left in Francisco's eyes. Reardon had never faced so solemn a look of respect.
Yes, Mr. Reardon, he answered quietly.
I told you that I didn't need it, and I insulted you for it. All right. You've won. That speech you made tonight. That was what you were offering me, wasn't it?
Yes, Mr. Reardon.
It was more than gratitude, and I needed the gratitude. It was more than admiration, and I needed that too. It was much more than any word I can find. It will take me days to think of all that it's given me. But one thing I do know. I needed it. I've never made an admission of this kind, because I've never cried for anyone's help. If it amused you to guess that I was glad to see you, you have something real to laugh about now, if you wish.
It might take me a few years, but I will prove to you that these are the things I do not laugh about.
Prove it now, by answering one question. Why don't you practice what you preach?
Are you sure that I don't?
If the things you said are true, if you have the greatness to know it, you should have been the leading industrialist of the world by now. Francisco said gravely, as he had said to the portly man, but with an odd note of gentleness in his voice,
I suggest that you think twice, Mr. Reardon.
I've thought about you more than I care to admit. I have found no answer.
Let me give you a hint. If the things I said are true, who is the guiltiest man in this room tonight?
I suppose James Taggart?
No, Mr. Reardon, it is not James Taggart.
But you must define the guilt and choose the man yourself. A few years ago I would have said that it's you. I still think that that's what I ought to say. But I'm almost in the position of that fool woman who spoke to you. Every reason I know tells me that you're guilty. And yet I can't feel it.
You are making the same mistake as that woman, Mr. Reardon, though in a nobler form.
What do you mean?
I mean much more than just your judgment of me. That woman and all those like her keep evading the thoughts which they know to be good. You keep pushing out of your mind the thoughts which you believe to be evil. They do it because they want to avoid effort. You do it because you won't permit yourself to consider anything that would spare you. They indulge their emotions at any cost. You sacrifice your emotions as the first cost of any problem. They are willing to bear nothing. You are willing to bear anything. They keep evading responsibility. You keep assuming it.
But don't you see that the essential error is the same? Any refusal to recognize reality, for any reason whatever, has disastrous consequences. There are no evil thoughts except one, the refusal to think. Don't ignore your own desires, Mr. Reardon. Don't sacrifice them. Examine their cause. There is a limit to how much you should have to bear.
How did you know this about me?
I made the same mistake once, but not for long.
I wish...
Reardon began and stopped abruptly. Francisco smiled.
Afraid to wish, Mr. Reardon?
I wish I could permit myself to like you as much as I do.
I'd give...
Francisco stopped. Inexplicably, Reardon saw the look of an emotion which he could not define, yet felt certain to be pain. He saw Francisco's first moment of hesitation.
Mr. Reardon, do you own any Danconia copper stock?
Reardon looked at him, bewildered.
No.
Some day, you'll know what treason I'm committing right now, but... Don't ever buy any Danconia copper stock. Don't ever deal with Danconia copper in any way.
Why?
When you'll learn the full reason, you'll know whether there's ever been anything or anyone that meant a damn to me, and how much he did mean.
Reardon frowned. He had remembered something.
I wouldn't deal with your company. Didn't you call them the men of the double standards? Aren't you one of the looters who is growing rich right now by means of directives?
Inexplicably, the words did not hit Francisco as an insult, but cleared his face back into his look of assurance.
Did you think that it was I who wheedled those directives out of the robber planners?
If not, then who did it?
My hitchhikers.
Without your consent?
Without my knowledge.
I'd hate to admit how much I want to believe you, but there's no way for you to prove it now.
No. I'll prove it to you within the next 15 minutes.
How? The fact remains that you've profited the most from those directives.
That's true.
I've profited more than Mr. Mouch and his gang could ever imagine. After my years of work, they gave me just the chance I needed.
Are you boasting?
You bet I am.
Reardon saw incredulously that Francisco's eyes had a hard, bright look, the look not of a party hound, but of a man of action.
Mr. Reardon, do you know where most of those new aristocrats keep their hidden money?
Do you know where most of the fair share vultures have invested their profits from Reardon metal?
No, but in Danconia copper stock, safely out of the way and out of the country. Danconia copper, an old invulnerable company, so rich that it would last for 3 more generations of looting.
A company managed by a decadent playboy who doesn't give a damn, who will let them use his property in any way they please and just continue to make money for them, automatically, as did his ancestors. Wasn't that a perfect setup for the looters, Mr. Reardon?
Only, what one single point did they miss?
Reardon was staring at him.
What are you driving at?
Francisco laughed suddenly.
It's too bad about those profiteers on Reardon metal. You wouldn't want them to lose the money you made for them, would you, Mr. Reardon? But accidents do happen in the world.
You know what they say. Man is only a helpless plaything at the mercy of nature's disasters.
For instance, there was a fire at the Danconia ore docks in Valparaiso tomorrow morning. A fire that razed them to the ground along with half of the port structures. What time is it, Mr. Reardon? Oh, did I mix my tenses?
Tomorrow afternoon, there will be a rock slide in the Danconia mines at Orano. No lives lost, no casualties, except the mines themselves. It will be found that the mines are done for, because they had been worked in the wrong places for months. What can you expect from a playboy's management? The great deposits of copper will be buried under tons of mountain, where a Sebastian Danconia would not be able to reclaim them in less than 3 years, and a people's state will never reclaim them at all. When the stockholders begin to look into things, they will find that the mines at Campos, at San Felix, at Las Heras have been worked in exactly the same manner and have been running at a loss for over a year. Only the playboy juggled the books and kept it out of the newspapers. Shall I tell you what they will discover about the management of the Danconia foundries, or of the Danconia ore fleet? But all these discoveries won't do the stockholders any good anyway, because the stock of Danconia copper will have crashed tomorrow morning, crashed like an electric bulb against concrete, crashed like an express elevator, spattering pieces of hitchhikers all over the gutters. The triumphant rise of Francisco's voice merged with a matching sound. Reardon burst out laughing. Reardon did not know how long that moment lasted or what he had felt. It had been like a blow hurling him into another kind of consciousness, then a second blow returning him to his own. All that was left, as at the awakening from a narcotic, was the feeling that he had known some immense kind of freedom, never to be matched in reality. This was like the Wyatt fire again, he thought. This was his secret danger. He found himself backing away from Francisco Danconia. Francisco stood watching him intently, and looked as if he had been watching him all through that unknown length of time. "There are no evil thoughts, Mr. Reardon," Francisco said softly, "except one, the refusal to think." "No," said Reardon. It was almost a whisper. He had to keep his voice down. He was afraid that he would hear himself scream it. "No. If this is the key to you, no. Don't expect me to cheer you. You didn't have the strength to fight them. You chose the easiest, most vicious way. Deliberate destruction. The destruction of an achievement you hadn't produced and couldn't match. That's not what you'll read in the newspapers tomorrow. There won't be any evidence of deliberate destruction. Everything happened in the normal, explicable, justifiable course of plain incompetence. Incompetence isn't supposed to be punished nowadays, is it? The boys in Buenos Aires and the boys in Santiago will probably want to hand me a subsidy by way of consolation and reward. There's still a great part of the Danconia Copper Company left, though a great part of it is gone for good. Nobody will say that I've done it intentionally. You may think what you wish. I think you're the guiltiest man in this room, said Reardon quietly, wearily. Even the fire of his anger was gone. He felt nothing but the emptiness left by the death of a great hope. I think you're worse than anything I had supposed. Francisco looked at him with a strange half-smile of serenity, the serenity of a victory over pain, and did not answer. It was their silence that let them hear the voices of the two men who stood a few steps away, and they turned to look at the speakers. The stocky, elderly man was obviously a businessman of the conscientious, unspectacular kind. His formal dress suit was of good quality, but of a cut fashionable 20 years before, with the faintest tinge of green at the seams. He had had few occasions to wear it. His shirt studs were ostentatiously too large, but it was the pathetic ostentation of an heirloom, intricate pieces of old-fashioned workmanship that had probably come to him through 4 generations, like his business. His face had the expression which these days was the mark of an honest man, an expression of bewilderment.
He was looking at his companion, trying hard, conscientiously, helplessly, hopelessly, to understand. His companion was younger and shorter, a small man with lumpy flesh, with a chest thrust forward and the thin points of a mustache thrust up. He was saying, in a tone of patronizing boredom, "Well, I don't know. All of you are crying about rising costs. It seems to be the stock complaint nowadays. It's the usual whine of people whose profits are squeezed a little. I don't know. We'll have to see. We'll have to decide whether we'll permit you to make any profits or not." Reardon glanced at Francisco and saw a face that went beyond his conception of what the purity of a single purpose could do to a human countenance. It was the most merciless face one could ever be permitted to see. He had thought of himself as ruthless, but he knew that he could not match this level, naked, implacable look, dead to all feeling but justice. Whatever the rest of him, thought Reardon, the man who could experience this was a giant. It was only a moment. Francisco turned to him, his face normal, and said very quietly, "I've changed my mind, Mr. Reardon. I'm glad that you came to this party. I want you to see this." Then, raising his voice, Francisco said suddenly, in the gay, loose, piercing tone of a man of complete irresponsibility, "You won't grant me that loan, Mr. Reardon? It puts me on a terrible spot. I must get the money. I must raise it tonight. I must raise it before the stock exchange opens in the morning, because otherwise—" He did not have to continue, because the little man with the mustache was clutching at his arm. Reardon had never believed that a human body could change dimensions within one sight, but he saw the man shrinking in weight, in posture, in form, as if the air were let out of his lumps, and what had been an arrogant ruler was suddenly a piece of scrap that could not be a threat to anyone.
Is there something wrong, Senor D'Anconia? I mean, on the stock exchange?"
Francisco jerked his finger to his lips with a frightened glance.
"Keep quiet," he whispered. "For God's sake, keep quiet."
The man was shaking.
"Something's wrong?"
"You don't happen to own any D'Anconia copper stock, do you?" The man nodded, unable to speak.
"Oh my, that's too bad.
Well, listen, I'll tell you, if you give me your word of honor that you won't repeat it to anyone. You don't want to start a panic."
"Word of honor," gasped the man.
"What you'd better do is run to your stockbroker and sell as fast as you can, because things haven't been going too well for D'Anconia Copper. I'm trying to raise some money, but if I don't succeed, you'll be lucky if you'll have 10 cents on your dollar tomorrow morning. Oh my, I forgot that you can't reach your stockbroker before tomorrow morning. Well, it's too bad, but—" The man was running across the room, pushing people out of his way like a torpedo shot into the crowd. "Watch," said Francisco austerely, turning to Reardon. The man was lost in the crowd. They could not see him. They could not tell to whom he was selling his secret or whether he had enough of his cunning left to make it a trade with those who held favors. But they saw the wake of his passage spreading through the room, the sudden cuts splitting the crowd like the first few cracks, then like the accelerating branching that runs through a wall about to crumble, the streaks of emptiness slashed not by a human touch, but by the impersonal breath of terror. There were the voices abruptly choked off, the pools of silence, then sounds of a different nature, the rising, hysterical inflections of uselessly repeated questions, the unnatural whispers, a woman's scream, the few spaced, forced giggles of those still trying to pretend that nothing was happening. There were spots of immobility in the motion of the crowd, like spreading blotches of paralysis. There was a sudden stillness, as if a motor had been cut off. Then came the frantic, jerking, purposeless, rudderless movement of objects bumping down a hill by the blind mercy of gravitation and of every rock they hit on the way. People were running out, running to telephones, running to one another, clutching or pushing the bodies around them at random. These men, the most powerful men in the country, those who held, unanswerable to any power, the power over every man's food and every man's enjoyment of his span of years on earth, these men had become a pile of rubble, clattering in the wind of panic, the rubble left of a structure when its key pillar has been cut. James Taggart, his face indecent in its exposure of emotions which centuries had taught men to keep hidden, rushed up to Francisco and screamed, "Is it true?" "Why, James," said Francisco, smiling, "what's the matter? Why do you seem to be upset? Money is the root of all evil. So I just got tired of being evil." Taggart ran toward the main exit, yelling something to Orrin Boyle on the way. Boyle nodded and kept on nodding with the eagerness and humility of an inefficient servant, then darted off in another direction. Cheryl, her wedding veil coiling like a crystal cloud upon the air as she ran after him, caught Taggart at the door.
"Jim, what's the matter?"
He pushed her aside and she fell against the stomach of Paul Larkin as Taggart rushed out. Three persons stood immovably still, like three pillars spaced through the room, the lines of their sight cutting across the spread of the wreckage. Dagny looking at Francisco. Francisco and Reardon looking at each other. Chapter 3. White Blackmail.
"What time is it?"
"It's running out," thought Reardon. But he answered, "I don't know. Not yet midnight." And remembering his wristwatch, added, "20 of."
"I'm going to take a train home," said Lillian.
He heard the sentence, but it had to wait its turn to enter the crowded passages to his consciousness. He stood looking absently at the living room of his suite, a few minutes' elevator ride away from the party. In a moment he answered automatically, "At this hour?"
"It's still early. There are plenty of trains running."
"You're welcome to stay here, of course."
"No, I think I prefer to go home."
He did not argue.
"What about you, Henry? Do you intend going home tonight?"
"No." He added, "I have business appointments here tomorrow."
"As you wish."
She shrugged her evening wrap off her shoulders, caught it on her arm, and started toward the door of his bedroom, but stopped.
"I hate Francisco D'Anconia," she said tensely. "Why did he have to come to that party? And didn't he know enough to keep his mouth shut, at least till tomorrow morning?"
He did not answer.
"It's monstrous, what he's allowed to happen to his company.
Of course he's nothing but a rotten playboy. Still, a fortune of that size is a responsibility. There's a limit to the negligence a man can permit himself." He glanced at her face. It was oddly tense, the features sharpened, making her look older.
"He owed a certain duty to his stockholders, didn't he?"
"Didn't he, Henry? Do you mind if we don't discuss it?" She made a tightening, sidewise movement with her lips, the equivalent of a shrug, and walked into the bedroom. He stood at the window, looking down at the streaming roofs of automobiles, letting his eyes rest on something while his faculty of sight was disconnected. His mind was still focused on the crowd in the ballroom downstairs and on two figures in that crowd. But as his living room remained on the edge of his vision, so the sense of some action he had to perform remained on the edge of his consciousness. He grasped it for a moment. It was the fact that he had to remove his evening clothes. But farther beyond the edge there was the feeling of reluctance to undress in the presence of a strange woman in his bedroom, and he forgot it again in the next moment. Lillian came out, as trimly groomed as she had arrived, the beige traveling suit outlining her figure with efficient tightness, the hat tilted over half a head of hair set in waves. She carried her suitcase, swinging it a little, as if in demonstration of her ability to carry it. He reached over mechanically and took the suitcase out of her hand.
What are you doing?
She asked. I'm going to take you to the station.
Like this? You haven't changed your clothes.
It doesn't matter.
You don't have to escort me. I'm quite able to find my own way. If you have business appointments tomorrow, you'd better go to bed.
He did not answer, but walked to the door, held it open for her, and followed her to the elevator. They remained silent when they rode in a taxicab to the station. At such moments as he remembered her presence, he noticed that she sat efficiently straight, almost flaunting the perfection of her poise. She seemed alertly awake and contented, as if she were starting out on a purposeful journey of early morning. The cab stopped at the entrance to the Taggart terminal. The bright lights flooding the great glass doorway transformed the lateness of the hour into a sense of active, timeless security. Lillian jumped lightly out of the cab, saying, "No, no, you don't have to get out. Drive on back. Will you be home for dinner tomorrow or next month?" "I'll telephone you," he said. She waved a gloved hand at him and disappeared into the lights of the entrance. As the cab started forward, he gave the driver the address of Dagny's apartment. The apartment was dark when he entered, but the door to her bedroom was half open, and he heard her voice saying, "Hello, Hank." He walked in, asking, "Were you asleep?"
"No."
He switched on the light. She lay in bed, her head propped by the pillow, her hair falling smoothly to her shoulders, as if she had not moved for a long time, but her face was untroubled. She looked like a schoolgirl, with a tailored collar of a pale blue nightgown lying severely high at the base of her throat. The nightgown's front was a deliberate contrast to the severity, a spread of pale blue embroidery that looked luxuriously adult and feminine. He sat down on the edge of the bed, and she smiled, noticing that the stern formality of his full dress clothes made his action so simply, naturally intimate. He smiled in answer. He had come prepared to reject the forgiveness she had granted him at the party, as one rejects a favor from too generous an adversary. Instead, he reached out suddenly and moved his hand over her forehead, down the line of her hair, in a gesture of protective tenderness, in the sudden feeling of how delicately childlike she was, this adversary who had borne the constant challenge of his strength, but who should have had his protection. "You're carrying so much," he said, "and it's I who make it harder for you."
"No, Hank, you don't, and you know it."
"I know that you have the strength not to let it hurt you, but it's a strength I have no right to call upon. Yet I do, and I have no solution, no atonement to offer. I can only admit that I know it and that there's no way I can ask you to forgive me."
"There's nothing to forgive."
"I had no right to bring her into your presence."
"It did not hurt me. Only..."
"Yes?"
"Only seeing the way you suffered was hard to see."
"I don't think that suffering makes up for anything, but whatever I felt, I didn't suffer enough. If there's one thing I loathe, it's to speak of my own suffering. That should be no one's concern but mine. But if you want to know, since you know it already, yes, it was hell for me, and I wish it were worse. At least I'm not letting myself get away with it." He said it sternly, without emotion, as an impersonal verdict upon himself. She smiled. In amused sadness, she took his hand and pressed it to her lips and shook her head in rejection of the verdict, holding her face hidden against his hand.
"What do you mean?"
he asked softly.
"Nothing."
Then she raised her head and said firmly, "Hank, I knew you were married. I knew what I was doing. I chose to do it. There's nothing that you owe me, no duty that you have to consider." He shook his head slowly in protest.
"Hank, I want nothing from you except what you wish to give me. Do you remember that you called me a traitor once? I want you to come to me seeking nothing but your own enjoyment.
So long as you wish to remain married, whatever your reason, I have no right to resent it. My way of trading is to know that the joy you give me is paid for by the joy you get from me, not by your suffering or mine. I don't accept sacrifices, and I don't make them. If you asked me for more than you meant to me, I would refuse. If you asked me to give up the railroad, I'd leave you. If ever the pleasure of one has to be bought by the pain of the other, there better be no trade at all. A trade by which one gains and the other loses is a fraud. You don't do it in business, Hank. Don't do it in your own life.